Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you once again to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we are broadcasting live from the beautiful Dillon State Park here in East Central Ohio. I'd like to remind all of you to please press the follow button, and you'll be notified 1 hour prior to the start of each Ohio Exopolitics. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is performed by your host. CDs are available on request. I'd like to welcome you to the strange, fascinating world of the paranormal, where we tackle the tough questions. Who are we? Are we alone? What is our real history? And Henry Kroll is going to help us answer some of those questions this evening. Henry, how are you doing tonight?
Real good, Mark. Good evening.
Well, I appreciate you jumping in at the last minute. We had a show scheduled for this evening with Amy Vickers. We were going to talk about the Star Child Skull. She wasn't able to join us. Got a cancellation, and Henry, you were good enough to pick up the slack here. And I think tonight's show is going to be really, really fascinating, so I'm kind of pumped about it. And one of the places I'd like to start out as I think we've had nuclear war in the past. I think we've had atomic warfare among what we call ancient civilizations. And there is a line from the ancient Hindu scripture called the Bhagavad Gita that talks about the ancient empire of Rama, which is said to have existed 12,000 years ago. And that would be 5,000 years before any civilization that we know about today. Let's listen to this clip.
The earth had been assaulted by a man-made weapon of incredible power. But what if it had all happened before? What if an explosion of even greater force and destructiveness had long ago shaped the earth's history? Atomic warfare among ancient civilizations may sound like something out of a science fiction novel, but descriptions of similar deadly occurrences can be found in the very same text Dr. Oppenheimer quoted after the New Mexico atomic test.
I remember the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
Part of an ancient Hindu scripture known as the Mahabharata. The Bhagavad Gita was written sometime between the 5th and 2nd century BC. This massive 100,000 verse text contains stories about the ancient empire of Rama, which it is said existed over 12,000 years ago, or roughly 5,000 years before the earliest recorded civilization in Mesopotamia.
If you read the ancient Indian epics, they read like modern-day science fiction. Yet they're thousands of years old, with references not only of flying chariots and of these gods that had these incredible technological capabilities, but incredible weapons that they used in those epic battles.
They had what was called a Brahma weapon. There were many people that were singed and burned and melted by the Brahma weapon.
Ancient astronaut theorists believe the Brahma weapon was an early nuclear device.
Henry, do you think that we had nuclear wars in the past?
All evidence points that way when you start looking at the radioactivity in the streets of Mohenjo-daro, this city in northern India. They found skeletons laying in the street holding hands. And currently we have Pakistan with, 50 or 30 nuclear weapons, and India has more. And it's like history is going to repeat itself. Let's hope not. But let's hope not that we're not that stupid. But they found vitrified glass stones there. An area where it was melted by intense heat. So it appears that they used some kind of a nuclear device at that time.
I guess with vitrification, the stone becomes molten. And then when it hardens again, it feels like glass. Isn't that correct?
Beaded glass, yes. It's bluish in color and fused and like the sands beneath the first atomic bomb test. This is what Oppenheimer observed when he made that quote from the Bhagavad Gita.
Henry, do you think that we had space travel in the ancient past? Like, do you think the ancient Egyptians had space travel?
I think we did several times. Earth has birthed several advanced races of people that have probably gone off and colonized space or just developed the technology to live in space, which is a concept that we can't seem to get through our brains. That if we had advanced technology, we don't need a planet. We don't have to invade anybody. We can go anywhere and live any place. And apparently the Egyptians, I think, had space travel. I've got a document behind me here that talks about the Chinese wanting to go travel to the moon. Chinese emperor, he sent to India to get the technology to build a spacecraft at that time. And then the ancient Indians also, they went to Greece, from what I understand, to get the technology from Greece in really ancient times, over 12,000 years ago. So all these things sort of tie in. And I emailed you a copy of a piece of jewelry, a breastplate, this large precious stones on it. Did you receive that?
Yes, I did. It's very interesting.
It looks just like booster rockets on the space shuttle at the bottom of the thing. And then in between are like smaller rockets with the bell-shaped housing below and then the oxygen tanks above. And then as you go up further on this breastplate, there's a scarab beetle, which is can't fly. He has anti-gravity properties in order to fly. And then you've got this boat thing, which is a celestial boat used to carry the pharaoh, they thought, or modern archaeologists thought, into the heavens, into the Duat. But they actually found a large boat about 120 feet long buried next to the pyramid in a specially built shaft for it in the rock. Did you see the picture of that?
Yes, I did. And I want to just remind everyone that's tuned in and listening to the show that you can see these pictures as they kind of flash in and out there at the when you log into the show there, it will show you these different pictures that Henry is talking about if you pay attention there. Yeah, those are very fascinating pictures, Henry.
Well, getting back to the breastplate, in this celestial boat is the Eye of Horus. And there's been people speculating that it was an actual Egyptian satellite. And this could piece of jewelry might be commemorating putting this device into orbit. And just above and somehow the Earth was mapped from orbit with precise longitude and latitude coordinates. There's many maps out that show this coastlines with high degree of accuracy. And we didn't develop longitude ability to determine it until somebody invented the chronometer in England. The king had a 20,000 pound reward for somebody to come up with a way to measure longitude, and that was in 1700s, I think, or no, prior to that. I don't remember the exact date, but it was nothing like this ancient technology. But anyway, this satellite, the Eye of Horus, apparently could record or view the entire Earth, and just above this eye is a capsule of some sort with three guys sitting in it. There's three figures in there. It definitely looks like some sort of space capsule.
I talked to Dr. Roger Lear when I was in Washington State up at James Gilliland's ranch this past year. And he told me and another radio talk show host up there something that was really fascinating. And I'm not sure if he wanted us to repeat this or not, but I have. So I guess I'll get in trouble, but if he wants to keep this a secret, I'm not sure. But he knew someone in Egypt that let him in on a secret. And at night, they drove him out somewhere to some dig, and they took him underground. And they traveled, you know, I mean, it was really dark. They're underground, and they traveled for quite some time. And then they got to the place that this individual wanted to show him, and they shined a light on the feet of this really large statue, and then they scrolled up the statue with a light, and you can see the face of this statue, and it clearly has a mask on, and it clearly has what appears to be something akin to like oxygen tank or some breathing apparatus on its back. And Dr. Lear said something to the effect that this is one of the secrets or one of the hidden secrets that they're hiding from us and keeping from us over there in Egypt. And I don't know if he's talked about it anymore, but I got an email from Mel Fabregas and this past week, who has a show called Veritas. He's been on the History Channel several times. And I told him that story when I was up in Washington State, and he just wanted to confirm that I had, you know, that he had the story correct. But yeah, I think there's a lot that's been hidden from us. Don't you agree, Henry?
Yes, I think so. Thoth, I believe, was the architect for the pyramids, and legend says that he gave mankind mathematics, architecture, healing, and practically every science we have. And Anubis, the dog-headed guy, he was the pilot of the spaceship and may have been a race of aliens that looked like dogs. I really don't know. Maybe there's some genetic mistakes made far in the past. As far as the oxygen tanks on this statue goes, Earth has lost 98% of its atmosphere from when it was first formed. It was very high pressure atmosphere, and if you know, it's very old actually, you know, 700 million year record of life on the planet from our studies, you know, back to the Cambrian era. Well, mankind's total existence, modern man, is only 200,000 or 300,000 years. So there could have been several advanced races left the planet when the atmosphere was very thick, and if they were to come back, say, a few thousand years ago, they would have to carry oxygen tanks with them to be able to breathe. It, depending on the, if you go up to 30,000 feet or more, your blood will boil, and so we're on the verge of losing our atmosphere on this planet right now.
Well, that's an interesting theory I hadn't thought of before, that some of these extraterrestrials may have in fact either visited the Earth a long time ago or may have been our ancestors who left. And then when they came back to an Earth that was in fact different than the one they left. Is that what you're saying, Henry?
Yes, it is. It's lost its atmosphere from two ways that I've come up with on my research when I wrote Cosmological Ice Ages. One of them is all of the layers of carbon on Earth. The limestone is calcium carbonate, and oil is also carbonate, and there's vast seas of oil down under the oceans, and coal 100 feet thick is carbon removed out of the air in the form of carbon dioxide and out of the water. Plants laid that down. So all of that accounts for maybe half of the atmosphere being disappearing, is being laid down through the process of photosynthesis over hundreds of millions of years. And then the other half is due to the Earth's expansion from the mid-ocean rifts at about 5 inches a year. It has almost doubled in size in the last billion years, from 700,000 or 700 million years ago to a billion years ago. It's expanded due to volcanic mid-ocean rifts and cracks in the various in the crust as the plates, continental plates, separate. And that can be measured. In fact, you can go on, anyone can go on Google Earth right now and type in age of the Hawaiian Islands, and you'll see that Kauai is 5,100,000 years, and then the Big Island is 400,000 years old. Subtract the age difference and measure it off on Google Earth and divide it into that distance, convert it into inches or whatever, and works out to 5 inches a year expansion.
Wow.
Anybody can do this with if you got half a brain. I mean, it's very basic mathematics there.
Well, I want to get us back to ancient India and the idea of flying cities. In the ancient Indian texts say that there were three giant cities that were orbiting the Earth at one time, and they said they were made of this gleaming iron. And at one point, these three cities went to war with each other. Let's listen to this next clip.
In the ancient Indian texts themselves, it says, and I quote, at one point, three giant cities were orbiting the Earth. And those giant cities were often described as being made of gleaming metal and iron. And at one point, those three cities went to war with each other. And it's described how the gods threw weapons at each other, destroying those cities, that it all went up in flames, and fire came raining down onto Earth.
Henry, wouldn't it have been great if they'd have taught us these things in school? I wonder if you could comment.
Yeah, I got fascinated with those flying cities after Kevin told me that story of one flying over his head in Florida when he was out hunting deer down there, and it was breaking off the treetops right above him, and that sounded very fascinating. So I started looking it up, and I have this blog called Flying Cities where I posted all of this ancient Indian lore on there. Plus, I found a newspaper clip in a Chilean newspaper where two jet pilots were flying along. And they thought there was a city on the map ahead of them was one that was further north than where the actual position was. And they just thought it was perfectly normal to look down there and see that city, but that sort of threw off their navigation. So when they got closer to the city, it took off in front of them and went up into space and just scared the heck out of them. And they flew back to their base in Chile, and the colonel there, he released the information in the newspaper, otherwise we wouldn't have that news story. And he believes that extraterrestrials or these flying cities exist, the colonel did there, of the Chilean Air Force.
Well,
so that was an interesting little article, that plus Kevin's experiences and then what I could find in the Mahabharata.
Let's step back to your friend Kevin who was hunting the deer. I think he was northwest of a place called Arta, Florida. And in your blog, it says that he saw this 1 mile across ship, and it didn't make any noise whatsoever, and that he said it was six stories high, and it had these rectangular windows that looked like a cruise ship. And didn't he shoot at it with his gun?
Yeah, he took a pot shot at it, which I thought was really radical at the time he told me the story. And I tape recorded his adventures so that I could transcribe them into a book. And it was breaking the live oak trees. Those things are tough. The limbs go out 30, 50 feet, you know, forever. And they make a loud noise. And if you were able to break them, you could hang on them out there 20, 30 feet away. You could never break one of those limbs off, you know. It's just crushing the tops of the trees above him. And he could look up the side to see it was multi-stories high, and they had large rectangular windows. Mm. I don't know how you'd make a spacecraft with rectangular windows. It doesn't make any sense to me at the time that I was recording that, but that's what he said. So, and then it wasn't very long afterwards that they saw this thing over Phoenix, Arizona, and it stayed up there for quite some time, many thousands. Thousands and thousands of people photographed it and looked at it.
Phoenix Lights.
Right after that, yeah. It was probably the same ship that sort of cruised over Phoenix and was taking a look at the development down there, taking some pictures of people on Earth, maybe.
You know, maybe there's a video on YouTube that claims to be describing a flying city around Mars. It's called The Shadow of Mars, and it was said to have been discovered by the Russian Phobos 2 mission. Have you seen that, Henry?
Yes, I have. It's very interesting. It's difficult to tell if those are actual buildings on this thing or not, but they claim to have this high-resolution ability to enhance the photographs. So it kind of looked like New York City there in one area, Long Island. Maybe it's replica of cities on Earth. I don't know.
You know, the American Indians say we're living in the fifth world. That means that there were four other civilizations that existed before us that were destroyed by stupidity or natural events like ice ages. What do you think of that, Henry? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I've written about that extensively on the underground tunnels all throughout South America. They probably built those in advance and knowing that something was going to happen where they could survive. And you know, the Aztec civilization completely disappeared, you know, and so did some of the other ones. We don't even know where they went, but they could go into those tunnels and come up some other place miles away. It would startle the people, you know. They used them as corridors, the natives. And there's been a lot of people wanting to explore those. I have a guy that called me and wanted me to go down there, and he was going to take Zachariah Sitchin with him. But he's, you know, was quite old at that time. He would never be able to walk those distances, and I don't think I could either. You have to be able to walk 30 to 40 miles a day through these tunnels, and they could have traps or dangerous areas in it. A lot of people that have gone in there have never come back out, so the government's sealed them up. I don't know if I should mention this guy's name, but he's from the Czech Republic. But he lives in Canada, and he's a gold miner. And he's going over to the mountains of Tibet here shortly. They've got some books over there in the Himalayas that no one has ever read. They're going to study those for a couple, 3 years. And it's about different metallurgy.
We don't know our own history, do we?
No, we haven't got a clue. And we've been kept dumbed down for specific purposes. They don't want us to think at all. And, you know, it's difficult to discern our history now because so much of it has been destroyed. But anyway.
You know, when you watch, like, MTV or something like that, it's so clear that the whole media is designed to kind of put us in this stupor and keep us from thinking, don't you think?
Yeah, right. you know, our society is very weird. If you could look at it from a different perspective, if you're an alien or something coming to Earth, you wouldn't want to interact with humanity because they'd be talking about the football game or something like that, you know. And anyway, we could go on to some other topic if you'd like. I'd rather not comment on our present civilization.
Okay.
I've got a blog I'm working on I'll put up there that'll make your hair stand on end.
Is that right? Well, let me, I want to talk a little bit. You may not know about this, Henry. This is something I've been researching myself just a little bit. There are these pillars in India that are rust-proof. And there's a pillar in India which is about 1,000 years old, which is made of metal, and it's near Delhi, and it hasn't rusted in 1,000 years. And there's another pillar that is 2,400 years old, and it's in a place called Polur, which I've never heard of before. They say the second pillar was created by tribal people. The Indian people had in addition to being able to make metal that wouldn't rust, the ancient Indian people had the ability to create zinc. And I think that zinc is a very difficult technology to create. It requires a very high temperature, and the zinc is only available within this very small window of about 3 degrees. And the Indian people have had this technology for like 4,000 years. I wanted to play this clip. It's from a man, some Indian man, who's speaking to a class teaching this. Very interesting.
Okay, metallurgy. Dinesh is B.Tech Metallurgy from IIT Bombay. You know, there are these pillars which are rust-proof in India. Do you know about them? The most famous one is in front of Qutub Minar. Yes? This is a 1,000-year pillar, 1,000 years old, and even the pollution of Delhi has not touched it. Yeah? It is still not rusting. Yeah? And the other one, this is near Bangalore in Kollur. Yeah? Where there is 750 centimeters of rain a year, 6 to 8 months a year. And this has been there for 2,400 years. Yeah? And it is rust proof. No rusting. About the second pillar, what is more interesting is it was not built by any expert. It was built by the tribal, the aboriginals of that area to welcome Adi Shankaracharya when he came to their village. Yeah? So this technology was there, not even with like the learned Brahmins or something like that. It was available to the tribals. Yeah? Then there is this mystery of zinc. You know, India held the sole knowledge of how to remove zinc from zinc ore for 4,000 years. Yeah, because zinc is a very, very interesting thing. Zinc, from the ore, the zinc becomes liquid at 997 degrees Celsius. But that same zinc then vaporizes and becomes gas at 1000 degrees Celsius. So it is only a 3-degree window that you have to pull that zinc out. And it is incredibly difficult. Yeah? You know what we did? It was very interesting. See, usually if you see a furnace, kya hota hai? There is the furnace and then something is coming out and being accumulated. Isn't it? This is the way most distillation is done. Yes or no? You've got the heat from the bottom and something comes out and it is collected. Now, when the heat was coming from the bottom, what would happen? The zinc would become liquid. It would go down or it would just evaporate and go out. Right? So what did these people do? They turned it upside down. They put the heat on the top and they put an ice bath below it, cold. So it would come down, then it would go in the cold, it would solidify and you would get the zinc. Yeah? For 4,000 years we kept this technique secret over here. Yeah? All the zinc in the world was made only by India. No.
Henry, I think it's quite interesting that we are starting to wake up to this kind of information. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I think it was about 20-some years ago I read in Scientific American how they built pillars, and they were speculating on why that particular one in India wasn't rusting. And it had they took some samples. It had a higher silicon content than our other iron. And I don't know about the zinc. I can't remember that part. But the article went into detail how they made iron pillars. Now, I'm sort of a backyard blacksmith, own a machine shop and have a big metal lathe and stuff. I still have a metal lathe across Cook Inlet over there. And they take and cast those in sections, those pillars. There's little microscopic cracks, I guess, they found in the pillar. And they could stack one block of iron on top of the other and then sort of blacksmith weld it together some way. Now, I don't know how they did that. Maybe they could exclude the oxygen and fasten them together that way and under some heat. And it might have been possible. Now, it's been proven in space. You can take two pieces of metal out in space like iron, polish them very carefully so that they're very clean, and then smack them together, and they're welded together because of the vacuum of space. And they might have been able to do that on Earth some way to build those pillars, but I really don't know. And you can't cast them in one piece because it takes about a year for them to cool off.
A year?
Well, they're a big chunk of iron, and it just takes a long time to get it cooled down enough to handle it. You know, it's I don't know how many thousand pounds it is, but when I was a kid, I was 20-some years old. At the time, I went down the Mississippi River, and I stopped in Tennessee. They have the Sprague there. It's supposedly the largest steam engine or largest paddle wheel steam tug in the world. And they have this huge 20-some feet diameter paddle wheel on the stern. And it has double expansion steam engine, big arms to turn this thing, you see. And it was the high pressure cylinder was 3 foot diameter, and the secondary double expansion and the cylinder was 6 foot diameter, and the big arm that turned the paddle wheel. Well, the shaft that the paddle wheel is mounted on, the guy gives you a tour of this thing, and this one large chunk of iron, 3 foot in diameter, that extends the width of the boat. I don't know how wide it is, a 30-foot or something like that. But he was saying, like, after they forged it, it took 3 years just to cool it off.
Amazing.
So it's a lot of mass there to get rid of all the heat. And so making those pillars would be kind of interesting technology to do that. I don't know how they did it, really. They just may have known more about metallurgy than we do at the present time in ancient India.
Well, Henry,
I have made zinc caps also. I used to own a tugboat. It was 72 foot long, and I had a 5 foot diameter propeller and a big square nut on the end that held it on there. And I'd take a 1 gallon paint bucket and clean it out and build a form, and I'd heat up a bunch of old zincs and melt them down with a weed burner and get them up to 1,000 degrees and use some firewood to get it hot and pour that zinc cap. And it would fit over my propeller nut. You put zincs on boats to stop corrosion And a big prop like that, you want to have zinc on the end of it because it stops the corrosion of the propeller, bronze propeller. And it's called a sacrificial metal. We always had them on all our boats, you know, and bolted on the rudder. And wherever there's a metal fitting through the hull, you have to have a slab of zinc. Pure zinc is the best.
Hmm. Well, that's very interesting. Very, very interesting. Henry, why don't we take a break for like 3 minutes and folks can refresh their drink or take a pit stop and we'll be right back.
We'll get into the philosopher's stone.
Right. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. We're speaking with Henry Kroll. One of his websites is www.alaskapublishing.com. And one of his great books is The Philosopher's Stone, which we'll be talking about in just a minute. I'd like to thank the folks that came to the show this evening. I'd like to thank Aaron Morarity, After Dark Radio, Hello After Dark, Blondun, Captain Spiritual Hawkeye, Crone, Earth Tuner, Eve One Heart, and we have maybe 6 anonymous guests in there tonight. We've also got Papa Bear One, RD47, and S. Ruth. Thanks, everyone, for coming to the show and for coming into the chat room. I always appreciate that. And what I'm going to do now, Henry, is play a little clip here. The ancient Indians knew of a star called Antares, which is the 15th brightest object in the sky. They called that star Gesta. It is like 40,000 times larger than our sun. However, because of the distance, it was only the 15th brightest star in the sky, yet somehow the ancient Indians were aware of its great size. Let's listen to this next clip.
That the Earth was round, we knew that it was not stationary, that it was moving. And this was thousands of years ago. Yes? Interesting, huh? Okay. Let's go a little bit into space. Now, there is this star called Antares. Antares. Ares means Mars. Red. This is also a red star, so it is called Antares. We like Mars. Okay? Now, it is the 15th or 16th brightest object in the sky. Alright. Yet, our elders, our ancients, they called it Jeshta. Okay. Now, what does Jeshta mean? You know what Jeshta means? Jeshta means the biggest, the oldest, the eldest. Now, why would they call the 15th brightest object, meaning there are many more brighter objects than this star in the sky, why would they call it the biggest? Yes? Intuitively, something that is brighter should be bigger. Yes or no? Right? But they called this one, the 15th brightest, they called it the biggest. Turns out they were right. It is 40,000 times bigger than our sun. In fact, it is one of the biggest objects known to man. Yes? Now, just imagine, you've got this group of people who have managed to name a star the biggest, and this was 5,000-7,000 years ago.
Henry, do you have any comment on this clip?
Yeah, I've heard of that particular star, but I can't verify the accuracy of their size of the thing by what modern records show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Betelgeuse is 800 to 1,000 solar masses. The estimates vary depending on where you get your information.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the biggest ones that I know of, and it's between us and Orion. But this one here that they're talking about, it's further away and much further away. And I'm not sure about the mass of the thing. I couldn't confirm that.
Sure. Very interesting, though. In your blog, it states that all ancient structures around the world were built as observatories to keep track of the Earth's inclination. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I think they were. Well, the entire world was mapped, and they used meridians, not degrees, at one time. And then all of these structures lay on specific meridians, and that was a system they used. And people were very concerned about the tilt of the Earth and the orbit of the moon, and that's why they lined these stones up so they could look at the moon or the solstice and the sunrise at specific times of the year. And I'm not sure which, I don't think one particular culture is responsible for all of the various monuments, but somehow they had a way of communicating this information from one side of the world to the other. Apparently the Egyptians had a network of boats or trading and across the Atlantic and around the world, because we're finding Egyptian artifacts in South America and in the Grand Canyon area and also in the deserts of the Southwest. I mean, you know, it seemed to have a civilization that expanded all over the entire globe. So there was some sort of communication going on there in ancient times. Maybe they just had technology comparable to our own. We don't know. And we can't duplicate these structures, by the way. There's a lot of the stones we can't lift with our biggest cranes. Ones in Stonehenge or the ones at the Temple of Baalbek weigh thousands of tons. There's stone floors on some buildings there in Central America that are 10,000 tons of stones. They're absolutely flat, polished flat, and laid out on the deck there. And it's just impossible to structures that they built. So obviously their technology or handling building materials was better than ours today.
Let me read a part of your book, The Philosopher's Stone. When you used to bring forth the Shekinah glory, the electric discharge of holy fire over the top of the ark, a signal can be broadcast across the galaxy in one Planck second. You don't have to wait millions of light years for answers when communicating with other intelligent races across the universe. If you tripled your intelligence, you could produce a holographic thought form image on the other side of the galaxy on a planet which the device was operating on. So, Henry, can you tell us about this ORM that could be used to produce an intergalactic communication device?
Yeah, well, I wrote that, you know, quite several decades ago. And, you know, I believe that this is alien technology. Radio waves are really stupid for communication when you come to think that everything is separated by hundreds or tens of light years or millions of light years. You're going to have to wait a long time to get an answer to any kind of communication. So you need to come up with something that's a lot faster. And this is a magnetic frequency we're dealing with here. There is no flow of electrons. You're not dealing with electrons. It's high magnetic frequency. Now, a magnet, just people don't understand that, but a magnet just puts out one power. There's no frequency to it, like an iron magnet or the North Pole of the Earth. It's about a half a gauze of magnetic force, depending on where you're standing, 0.5 or it used to be 0.1 at the equator or something like that, but I mean one gauze. But anyway, when you're dealing with frequency, and everything in nature seems to deal with magnetic frequency, and that's how fractals geometry is created, with magnetic vibration, not electric. Whenever you got a flow of electrons, it's not efficient. You generate heat, so the human body doesn't really operate on the flow of electrons like you suggested. It's a magnetic conducting from one atom to the other. And these particles, this Shekinah glory, the M state, the ORMIS, it's another word for it. You can go on YouTube and there's a lot of misinformation on ORMIS. You got to listen to David Hudson's material if you're going to get any kind of an idea what this stuff does. And there's so much disinformation out there now. There's even warnings about taking it, and they're saying it is in your energy drinks. I mean, that's all baloney. Your Red Bull doesn't have ORMIS in it, but not to any great amount. In fact, once you get right down to it, everything has this in it. It's a very plentiful material. It's in the air you breathe right now, it's in the water you drink, it's everywhere. It's just finding it in large quantities isn't too hard if you understand it and know how it's formed or where it is. To find out that, you probably have to read the book. But anyway, we're dealing with magnetic frequency, and it fits a technical definition of a superconductor, but you're not really conducting electricity. The electrons on these atoms are Cooper paired. That means they're in a circle, kind of like they're not in a shell, like an electron shell. They're more like the orbits of material around Saturn or the model of our galaxy, but they're orbiting in opposite directions. So you got electrons passing each other at twice light speed. They have a unique ability of inhabiting the same place at the same time, or in different places at the same time. I mean, it's a little hard for us to get, but they, in other words, they live in multiple dimensions. The electrons do when they're in that state, and this creates a time field around the particle itself, which is basically two gold or two platinum group metal atoms that are combined with all the protons in the center. When you have particles like that, there's a lot of it. This is very abundant material. It may outnumber third-dimensional matter thousands to one, 10,000 to one by some estimates. And it's in the air. It's all around us. But it doesn't form a bond, so you can kind of swim through it, walk through it. It's not a solid material. It slides over itself kind of like water because of the shape of these things. They can't form an electron bond. They've just got paired electrons. And the nucleus is quite weak. The atomic forces are weak because you got so many protons in there. They push apart. Yet they're fairly stable, the particles are. They're like little magnets of the same polarity, so they just push apart. So you've got weak atomic forces. And you can rearrange this material and transmute it into other elements by simply hitting it with a magnetic pulse of some kind or another, magnetic frequency. Now, the human body, I believe, operates with this material. It conducts signals to the brain and to the muscles through the microtubules that connect all of the tissues in the body. And it's an instantaneous communication because you're dealing with magnetic frequency. If you're using electrons and pushing them through there, electrons, whenever you push it through an atom, it pops out the other side. It releases infrared photons, which are heat. It's not a very efficient way to transmit messages because you got all that heat loss. You're actually losing particles in a very small, minute amount of mass. I don't know if anybody understands this, but this is the way I understand that it works. And table tennis players can't hit the ball fast enough using nerve impulses and electrons. So something else is working there other than just electrons. So it has to be the arms or the ormus conducting through the microtubules that distributes the information throughout the body. And it also increases your intelligence if you've got more of it in the brain because they form better connections.
Well, let me back up a little bit and try to understand this. This philosopher's stone, it's a white powdered gold, correct? And it will actually disappear when it's heated up. Is that true?
Well, it has many states of matter. You see, it can be a glass, a gold glass, or it can be a rhodium and gold. It can be a black guck. It looks like iron. It tests iron, but it's not iron. It's just ormus. They found this stuff leaking out of the ground over there in Tibet million years ago or thousands of years ago, and the dogs and the monkeys were eating this stuff. And so the Tibetan monks started eating it, and they call it the black stone, you know. And what it is rhodium in this state that's a natural on-the-ground form, you know. It exists in deserts in the southwest mixed with magnesium. I think Great Salt Lake has tons of the stuff in there, you know, millions of tons. The Great Salt Lake precipitate, but it also has salt and magnesium. Magnesium is good for you. I guess you need it in your body. And if you look through the dry washes in the deserts, you'll see a white layer, a couple inches thick, maybe 2 or 3 feet down below the surface. That's this same material that's leached down whenever it rains. It forms a layer after laying there for thousands of years. It sort of collects in a certain area, and it's very fine, so it kind of filters down through the other rock strata and the sand and the gravel. The technology is out there, but it's all on YouTube now. You can find it if you're interested in it, and maybe it's the savior of the human race. It could be anyway, I think. That's why I kind of wrote the book. The ancient Hebrews were able to genetically engineer their people by starving the old people out until they died and feeding the children this material to rebuild their DNA to make them smarter and stronger. That's what
amazing.
I think they did.
So the ancients knew about this white powdered gold, right?
Well, yeah, I believe they carried it in the Ark of the Covenant, which is basically a Faraday cage. It responds to magnetic fields, and it has magnetic frequency. it fits a technical definition of a superconductor, but there's no, it has thousands of amps in it, but no voltage. It can lay there in that box, and if somebody comes near it that has a little magnet frequency to their body, it can form a discharge of electricity and kill them.
Ah.
And so there's a ways maybe we could use it to produce power, electric power. But a friend of mine that called me up, and we've been talking for some time. He died a few years ago now, but he's down there in Colorado. He found a natural deposit of it, and he was building these little miniature arcs of the Covenant. He called me up, and he says he had one 4 inches by 5 inches and put this white powder in there and put the electrodes on it, a milliammeter. It was only producing maybe a fraction of a volt, you know. So mm-hmm. he put a little salt water in there and checked it a few days later. It was putting out 32 volts. And he called me again. It was putting out 64 volts. And I says, well, maybe you ought to take it outside in case it explodes. You know, he had it in his garage. So over a period of a month, it went up to 440 volts. And
yeah.
it stayed there. But he added a little salt water to it to help the conductivity, I guess. This
huh.
little box of wood with two brass welding rods in it, and he didn't use gold; he just had brass. And
well, Henry,
sitting there putting out 440 volts forever, you know, and but there was no amperage to speak of.
Huh. So it was just putting out this electricity. It's
yeah,
almost like
it's, so he built two of them for his grandsons. He's had two grandkids, and then they took them to a science fair, and they had these things, and they're sitting there in the science fair, and they're putting on, they measure them with a voltmeter, putting out 440 volts, both of them. Science teachers looked at that, and they didn't understand it. They didn't even give them a blue ribbon, you know.
Really?
It went right over the top of their head. What they thought there was a battery in there or something. I don't know.
Huh.
It's pretty nutty.
That is an amazing story, Henry. Well, Henry, we are pretty much out of time. Did you want to tell folks about the rest of your books and your website and stuff like that?
Well, I have guarddogbooks.com, and my son put that one together for me. It's got a picture of my dog on there in his usual position. And I've been working on these blogs on this anti-gravity stuff for quite some time, and right now I'm working on a wood chip plant. I'm building a plant to make pellets for pellet stoves. We have a lot of waste wood up here.
Mm.
And I'm trying to get some financing to finish buying the machinery. One of the machines got to come from China, and it's $32,000 over there, plus freight. It produces about 300 to 600 kilograms an hour. For pellet stoves. The government likes that stuff right now. It's very clean burning. There's leaves very little ash residue, and it's like better than cleaner than coal.
Mm.
So EPA and everybody's for that sort of stuff. And I got into this project about a couple months ago, and it's quite interesting. I found out there's another plant up already built in Fairbanks, but they're not running at full capacity, about half producing pellets, because there's not enough people who have stoves for that. And
well, Henry,
you dump 40-pound sack in the stove, and it'll burn all day long, and it'll heat a 1,500-square-foot house, cheaper than natural gas.
Wow.
And
that's
clean
pretty
burning.
Cool. That's awesome.
And so you can probably do it in the city. There's no smoke or anything.
Wow.
Very little air pollution. And
well, that's a pretty nifty little thing you got going there, Henry. I want to thank you again for coming on the show, especially with such short notice, and it's been a fascinating conversation. And you have a good evening, sir.
Thank you, and we have so much more to talk about.
Well, I'm sure you'll be back. Have a good one.